What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
More than 70,000 people have been murdered in Gaza and the West Bank due to Israel's unceasing assaults and fast-moving genocide that escalated, not began, but escalated after October 7th. Since that time on this show, we've spent most of our Mondays bringing you an hour of coverage on what is happening in Palestine. We continue that coverage this morning. Our guest today is Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is the author of a brand new book, Understanding Palestine and Israel. We're going to walk through some headlines with Phyllis this morning. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Kat.
Thanks for joining. Phyllis, I want to start this morning actually with the West Bank, where Israel launched a full-throttle assault yesterday, demolishing homes, forcing people out of the refugee camps, their villages. I saw an interview with someone who's like one of the oldest homes in the area. The people of the West Bank are saying that Israel is using Gaza-like tactics. What does that mean and what is happening on the ground?
Well, there's been a major escalation going on in the West Bank, certainly since the escalation in Gaza that began, as you say, in the escalation that started on October 7th, 8th of 2023. In the West Bank, it has gone through an even greater escalation since the beginning of the ceasefire in January, on January 19th. And since that time, there's been more than 40,000 people expelled from their homes. The destruction across a number of towns and refugee camps, particularly in Jenin refugee camp, and areas around Tulkarm in the north of the Gaza, of the West Bank, 40,000 people expelled and thousands of homes destroyed. The reports are that the Jenin camp itself is virtually entirely destroyed. And Israeli officials are now saying that Palestinians who have been either expelled from their homes or had their homes demolished will not be allowed to return. What is going to happen to them remains very unclear. There are now tanks, over the weekend, tanks entered Jenin and are staying there. That has not happened in more than 20 years. It was not since 2002, at the height of the very violent Second Intifada, that Jenin was also a center of Israeli repression and assault. That was the last time that there were tanks deployed in the West Bank. So this is a major escalation. While the attention of the world, to the degree that it's focused on Palestine at all, is focused on Gaza for appropriate reasons, given the longevity of this genocide that has been continuing since October of 2023. But what's going on in the West Bank is now being described, as you say, as Gaza-like, meaning massive numbers of people being expelled from their homes, bombing and shelling, tank fire that is leaving massive destruction of towns and refugee camps. People are unable to move between villages in many cases, between cities in the West Bank. So it's a major escalation that we're seeing in the conditions of life. And more than 100 people have been killed in recent weeks. So there's a major escalation both at the human scale and at the scale of the towns and refugee camps themselves across the West Bank, even while settler violence escalates along with the state violence carried out by the army and police.
Phyllis, your book does some of this, but help us understand the geography, right, of the occupied territories and also what that means in terms of where people can flee when the assaults escalate. So on the Gaza Strip, we followed those of us over here as best as we could who don't know the geography very well. But we understood that people being pushed, you know, north to the south.
Well,
what does that mean in the West? Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the Gaza Strip, of course, people cannot flee to any place safe. There is no place that's safe in Gaza. Gaza is completely walled off. We hear a lot about the apartheid wall in the West Bank, which was originally described as a way of dividing the West Bank from what is recognized by Western countries as the Israeli borders. Israel itself, of course, has never defined its own borders, but what is broadly speaking recognized as the Israel of 1948, before the occupations of 1967. But in fact, that wall surrounding the West Bank was never that. It was always inside the West Bank itself, so that about 15% of the land of the West Bank has been taken just in land along that edge, along that border, where the fence is actually inside, taking, among other things, the six major water aquifers, the six major water sources of the West Bank, are all now walled off onto the Israeli side. Similarly, there's a wall surrounding Gaza. Part of Gaza is on the sea, on the Mediterranean, but the rest of it is completely walled in. That's the basis for which people often say that Gaza is like an open-air prison. It's open to the sky, but it is completely sealed off. And there is, as a result, no place safe. Now, there are divisions. Some places within Gaza are more dangerous than others. People have been forced by the Israeli military to flee from the northern part of Gaza to the south, leaving the south even more densely crowded with virtually no shelter available. 80% of all the buildings have been destroyed. People have been living in tents that are largely now destroyed from the weather. It's been a very cold winter with a great deal of rain, so that the question of exposure has been a major source of disease, and babies have now died of hyperthermia because they simply cannot get warm in these torn tents in the rain. So all of that is continuing in Gaza. And the notion that there, what we were told and what the people of Gaza were told was, you must flee to the south to be safe because the north will again be in our crosshairs. As it turned out, the south was not safe either. And bombing and shelling had continued by the Israeli military against those in the south, continuing with even greater force against those who refused to leave, who stayed in the rubble of their homes in the north. In the West Bank is bigger, although it's still a very small part of the territory of historic Palestine. All of Gaza and the West Bank together, as well as the Palestinian, the occupied part of Jerusalem, all together is only 22% of historic Palestine. So when people talk about dividing up the West Bank into enclaves, that the settlers would get what amounts now to about 60% of the land, and the rest, you know, that should be enough for a Palestinian state, something like that. It simply doesn't take into account the reality of this small amount of territory for a population that is now over 3.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank, 2 million in Gaza. So the question of where to flee is a very real one. There is no place safe. In Gaza, it's possible to, if people can get out of their villages, some of the villages have been actually sealed off, but people can flee in theory to the hills, into the mountains of the West Bank. But we're talking about elders, pregnant women, babies, children who can't make that kind of a hike. The roads are in the main being cut off. There are checkpoints all along the roads, so that it's very, very difficult to move around in the West Bank. So there's very little clarity about where the people who lived in those demolished homes, the 40,000 that have been expelled in the areas in and around Jenin, where are they supposed to go? They end up in other refugee camps, holed up in incredibly crowded, rather dilapidated because they were never allowed to be rebuilt, homes with family, with friends, people taking in more and more that their houses are simply not designed to hold so many. There's a shortage of water, a shortage of food. People can't get to medical care. So it's very dire conditions in the West Bank that are approaching those that we have seen in the last 16 and a half months across Gaza. That's what people are talking about when they say this is now Gaza-like conditions.
Phyllis, from an article on Al Jazeera, quote, the Israeli media is quoting sources close to Netanyahu that the army is intending to create large corridors in Tulkarem and Jenin, reminiscent of the so-called Netzarim corridor in Gaza, in order to allow free movement for its forces and heavy equipment. You help us understand some of the building blocks that got us to where we are. Walk the listeners through what the if I'm saying it wrong, please correct me, Netzarim corridor is, and what something like that would mean for the West Bank.
The Netzarim corridor in Gaza is a road that was created by Israeli armored bulldozers. These are Caterpillar D9 bulldozers specially made to accept being armored by the Israeli military. And they simply tear up anything in their path, houses, paths, other roads, whatever. And in this case, the Netzarim corridor is across Gaza, dividing Gaza between north and south. It's about 100 meters wide, and it goes across the entire width of Gaza. So it divides Gaza into two parts. And what it means is that the Israelis can and do simply settle their bulldozers and their soldiers in this road and prevent people from crossing from one part of Gaza to the other. It gives them complete control. What they are talking about doing now, apparently, according to Al Jazeera's coverage, and I think there's been some additional coverage as well, is the creation of similar roads across parts of the northern West Bank to divide the territory so that people cannot move from, in this case, perhaps from Jenin to Tul Karem or from Nablus back to Jenin. The villages that surround those cities will be completely cut off from their places of work, places of school, from commerce, from markets, from religious institutions, from all of that, as well as healthcare. That is not the Israeli concern. Their concern is we are going to mow down anything in our way, which could be houses, it could be mosques, it could be markets, it could be, we don't know what it will be. And we are going to build a road that we will then control and tell people when they are or are not allowed to be on that road. And if they have the temerity to travel on what has always been a Palestinian road that is now suddenly an Israeli occupation road, they will be subject to being bombed and killed. So that's the model that I think we're hearing about to be created in the West Bank, similar to what we're already facing in Gaza.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to tug on that thread just a little bit more. Can you talk historically about the ways in which the restriction of movement, the militarization of movement, has been used as a tactic of war, by Israel?
Sure. You know, how we understand history always has a lot to do with when we start the clock. You made a point earlier in our discussion, which I really appreciated, of making clear that when we talk about what began on October 7th and 8th was not a beginning, that it was an escalation of something that was already underway. And this is sort of the same notion. If you start looking at the question of what has happened since October 7th, you're going to get one version of history. If you look at what happened on October 7th as a continuation of what began in, say, 17 years before that, in 2006, when Israel imposed its blockade on Gaza, you're going to get a different understanding of history. If you go back to 1967, when the military occupation of Gaza began, you're going to get still a different one. And if you go back to the turn of the century with the beginning of the large-scale movement that became known as Zionism, the movement of European Jews into Palestine, you're going to get still another. So the question of when we start the clock is crucial to all this. The question of controlling movement has always been a part of Israeli strategy of occupation and apartheid. If we go back to what Palestinians call the Nakba, the war of 1967, 1947-48, that resulted in the creation of the State of Israel, 750,000 Palestinians were expelled and dispossessed of their lands, lost their homes, left carrying the keys, thinking they would be home in 2 or 3 weeks when the fighting ended. And all of those people, including 80% of the population of Gaza who were expelled in 1948, were never allowed to go home, were never allowed to return, despite the right to return being a clear part of international law, a special United Nations resolution, Resolution 194, that deals specifically with the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their home. Despite all of that, the Israelis just simply said, we're not going to allow the Palestinians to come home because if we did, their return would change the demographic balance of our country. Now, that's certainly true. It would change the demographic balance of those who are allowed to be officially part of the country they created. The problem is that's not an excuse to violate international law, unless the powerful countries of the world, most importantly our own, the United States, says that that'll be fine. We will support that denial of international law, that violation of international law. So the refusal to allow people to move, in this case, to move back to their homes, has always been a component of how dispossession happens, how occupation happens, how colonialism happens, how apartheid happens. Throughout the years of Israeli occupation, particularly in the West Bank, there are roads that are allowed for only only Israeli settlers, Jewish settlers who live in the Jews-only settlements across the West Bank are the only ones who are allowed to drive on those roads. Palestinians are not permitted on certain roads. This is something that the South Africans who have come to the West Bank in the context of seeing Israeli apartheid close up have said this never occurred in apartheid South Africa. There were never roads that Black people could not be on, despite all of the oppression that faced Black people under apartheid in South Africa. That was never one of the examples of it, as it has been from the beginning in Israel. And now we're seeing an escalation of those separations where people are not allowed to move between cities from their village to the next city in town, where people can't get to work. I've been hearing from friends in the West Bank that driving now from Ramallah to the checkpoint into Jerusalem, which used to be about a 20-minute drive, something like that, can take 6 hours because of checkpoints. Every checkpoint, lines of cars stopped and stalled until the soldiers decide that they've been moving slowly enough and maybe they'll allow a few cars to go through. It's the absolute disparity of power where the occupying powers have complete control over people's lives.
Phyllis, your new book also delves into, and I think it's important because I think that that folks throw terms around, right, as things come into our consciousness or become mainstream points of conversation, as Zionism has since October 7th in this country in a very escalated and different way. What is Zionism? Where did it come from?
That's a good question. Zionism is an ideological framework that became a political movement in the 1880s and 90s. The founder of modern Zionism, Theodor Herzl, saw the creation of a Jewish state as the only viable solution to anti-Semitism, which was on the rise across Europe and particularly in Russia. But in Western Europe as well. And in the early stages, the early Zionist leadership was very clear that, number one, this should be a secular movement, that it was not the same as the religious Zionism of the Bible that sort of envisioned, in one of the prayers, one of the Jewish prayers, there's a line, next year in Jerusalem, that was understood as an idealized religious point, that this was not that, that this was a secular movement. And further, they understood that it would require, because this is the era of colonialism, that they would require support by a colonial power for the creation of what would be a rather small state and a Western state in an Eastern part of the world, in the Arab world. And the role of Theodor Herzl in particular, not in his book, The Jewish State, but in his diaries, which he published later, in his diaries, he writes about one of the ways in which they understood what being a colonial project meant. And for Herzl, you know, others in the Zionist leadership, as well as Herzl, had gone to various imperial leaders. They had gone to the leadership of the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire, and the British Empire and the French trying to get their support for the creation of a Jewish state in the Arab world, in Palestine. And at one point, the main leader of the Zionist movement, Herzl, wrote to the infamous British colonialist, Cecil Rhodes, asking for his support, asking for him to try and persuade the British crown to support this idea of a Jewish state. And he writes to Herzl and he says, you know, you might wonder, why am I asking you for support? You're interested in Africa. I'm interested in this little slice of Arabia. You're concerned about Englishmen. I'm concerned about Jews. So why am I asking you? And then he answers his own question and he says, because our projects are both something colonial. And I remember for myself, I grew up a very strong Zionist. I was an active, you know, in Zionist youth groups, all of that. I remember reading that as a young adult, studying imperialism, studying all of that in the context of Vietnam, and thinking, whoa, nobody ever told me that part. And went back to read it all, and it was something far different than I had understood. So Zionism was always a colonial project. Now, it was something that was that remained a minority position among Jews around the world through the early years of the 20th century. It wasn't really until the Holocaust. And in the context of the Holocaust, when survivors of the Holocaust and those who had managed to escape ahead of the Holocaust were trying desperately to get into safety in the United States, and somewhat into the UK, but primarily in the United States, which is where many had family and wanted to go. And they were denied because of the combination of anti-Semitism and anti-communism in US laws that kept large percentages of European Jews out of the United States and giving them no other alternative of where to go than the British-controlled Palestine at that time. So in that context, Zionism began to emerge as what became rather quickly the majority position. Prior to that, the majority position had been one supported by organizations like the Jewish Bund in Russia and others, who said that they believed that anti-Semitism could only be overcome in collaboration with others who were fighting against their own versions of what we would now say other versions of racism. They didn't necessarily use that language, but that running away was not the right approach. And in fact, there was a great deal of sort of anti-Zionist viewpoints, not least in places like Russia, where Jews were under attack by the Cossacks, by others in these pogroms that were very, very violent. Men were killed, women were raped, stores were burned down, whole villages were destroyed. And in that context, the people coming in to carry out those atrocities were saying, you don't belong here, Jews don't belong here, you should get out. And for many, what they saw later after the violence was over, that Zionist leaders would come in saying, you don't belong here, you should come with us to this other country. And people said, why would we leave? This is what the people carrying out the pogroms said, that you Jews don't belong here. We do belong here. We have lived here for centuries. These are the languages we speak. This is where our families are buried. We don't want to leave. So it was a very tense relationship for many, many years. And it really wasn't until after the Holocaust that it became a dominant majority view among Jewish communities in many parts of the world.
Phyllis, I want to talk a little bit about what happened over the weekend regarding the ceasefire, so-called ceasefire. We know there hasn't been a cease of any firing. But over the weekend, Israel refused to release 620 prisoners, although Hamas kept its end of the deal and released six hostages. Hundreds of Palestinians were waiting for their loved ones, only to be devastated. Hamas now says negotiations are frozen until the folks are released. Netanyahu says he was offended by the ceremonies during the release of Israel's captives, and unless they promise to do it his way, he's not going to release folks, and says that he's prepared to resume assaults on the Gaza Strip. But the truth, Phyllis, right, is that he never stopped. And he has consistently violated the terms of the agreement, including preventing humanitarian aid, stopping the delivery of mobile homes and tents that displaced folks desperately need, to your point, especially given the current weather conditions in Palestine. Your reaction to the events over the weekend, your thoughts?
Well, it's been a pretty horrendous weekend, as you say. The families of Palestinian prisoners have faced incredible repression throughout this process. The prisoners have been released, but all of them have been released late, usually late at night. And the prisoners' families in Jerusalem and in some of the parts of the West Bank were visited by Israeli soldiers who ordered them not to celebrate, that there not be any celebrations visible. They were told not to have events in their homes with families. And in many cases, we're talking here certainly about a number of prisoners who were being held under so-called administrative detention, which means there were never charges brought, no convictions, no reasons given, simply people packed up and put in prison, including women and children who were held on administrative detention, as well as some prisoners who have been in Israeli jails for years. So the excitement of families has been palpable, and they were told you may not celebrate. So the way that these releases happened has been very problematic. There was a huge problem that happened that seems to have been just a major logistical mistake over the weekend with the release of Sherry Bibas, the woman who apparently was killed along with her two young children, a baby and a toddler, all of them killed. It was very tragic in an Israeli airstrike during the first month of the that they were held after October 7th. And in that return, there were apparently enough other people were killed in the same airstrike, in the same building they were being held in. The family was being held apparently in a building in Gaza that was destroyed by the Israeli military in an airstrike and was killed at the same time as others in the building, and one of the bodies was mixed up. So the body that was returned was not that of the woman who they had said they were returning. And her body was returned the following day. But it was, of course, a tragic thing for Israelis and particularly for her family. It was completely tragic. The Israeli position now is that they are claiming that they were not killed in an airstrike, but were killed by hand by those holding them, who apparently was not Hamas, but one of the small organizations that was operating in Gaza, but without providing any information to justify that. The chances that it was an airstrike is certainly a much more likely possibility. But so there's been problems on both sides of the how the returns to families have been carried out, but they have been carried out until now. Until Netanyahu decided on this one, there were 602 prisoners who were supposed to be released this weekend, and Netanyahu simply said, "We're not going to do it because we don't like how you have released the other the hostages." So right now there's a stalemate. Hamas has said that they will not negotiate moving into phase two of the so-called ceasefire arrangement. Only phase one was actually agreed to. The second and third phases were proposed but not agreed to. The idea was that there would be negotiations on those following phases during the 6 weeks of phase one while these various prisoner and hostage exchanges were underway. But those negotiations have not taken place yet. So right now, we're waiting to see if the 602 prisoners who were supposed to have been released on Saturday will in fact be released, and then whether they will go into negotiations into phase two, which is supposed to include the return of all 63 hostages that are left, about 30 of whom are assumed to be still alive, and the release of somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 prisoners who are due to be released at the same time, along with a full Israeli withdrawal of troops and a permanent end to the war. It's all very doubtful right now because Netanyahu has made clear he is not prepared to call for an end to the war. He is not prepared to carry out the full withdrawal that his team agreed would be on the table in phase two. And he's been unwilling even to restart the talks. He has essentially said that he's only open to negotiating the terms of Hamas's surrender. So whether this goes on to phase two and three right now is very, very doubtful. I think there is a chance that the final parts of phase one may still happen. The pressures on the Israeli government for the release of more hostages has been fierce. And it's Netanyahu himself who has every personal reason to want the war to continue, because as long as the war continues, he remains out of jail. He's facing the very likelihood of going to prison. And he will do anything, it's become quite clear, to avoid that from happening. So that's what we're now looking at, what we're now facing. So right now, everything is on tenterhooks, waiting to see whether the things that were supposed to happen over this weekend are able to happen in the next couple of days before the official end of the first stage, which is supposed to be on March 1st.
Phyllis, I want to talk to you about Trump's reaction, but we don't have a bunch of time. So I think I'm just going to say, Trump has now said, I mean, he's said several things, and who knows which one he's holding on to, if any of them. But he says he supports whatever Netanyahu wants to do. Right. I think the last time we chatted, we were still wondering what a Trump presidency could or would mean for Gaza. We're about a month in and we're seeing some pretty incredulous stuff, you know, including now the United States is going to go resettle the Gaza Strip. But I think, and I know this is another big question, it's sort of like the Zionism question, but I'm trying to like unpack some of the stuff you help us unpack in the book, is in a very short period of time. Walk us through how this country became so entangled.
Oh, that's a very hard
issue.
One to do really short.
You got 5 minutes.
Okay, here's the short version. The U.S. was always a supporter of the creation of a Jewish state in the region, but it was not the main supporter. It was not where the pre-state Zionist militias that became the Israeli military after the state was declared. They weren't getting their weapons from the U.S. mainly. They were mainly getting them from Czechoslovakia, which was then, of course, part of the Warsaw Pact, and from France. So the U.S. was not the main partner. There was nothing like what we now reference as the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. That relationship began after 1967 with the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem and the Syrian Golan Heights and the Egyptian Sinai. It was in that context, it started first in the Pentagon, who looked at this and said, wow, these guys are good. We could do business with these people. The mythology of the moment was the tiny, plucky little Israel had stood up to five Arab armies that had invaded. There were a lot of problems with that. It wasn't actually true. There were really only two armies, not five, but whatever. That was the popular mythology of the moment. And in response to that, the Pentagon opened a massive level of very, very strong collaboration on business. That was a big part of it, on production of weapons, on training together, on all those things. And very quickly, now this is in the middle of the Cold War, right? So the U.S. is very concerned about the Soviet Union gaining influence throughout the oil-rich region of the Middle East. This is still at the point where access to oil is very crucial. That's not true now, and it hasn't been for several decades. But at that time, that was the big issue, along with the ability to counter Soviet influence. So in that context, the U.S. starts to really build up its relationship with Israel, and this so-called special relationship emerges from that. It was always a question within the region. The U.S. also had strong ties with oil-producing Arab states, particularly in the Gulf, the Saudis, the UAE, et cetera. And they also were very concerned about stability and military expansion. So those three pillars, Israel, oil, and stability, were always crucial. And they realized at some point you could rarely have all three. You could really only have two at a time. You know, if you had a really tight relationship with Israel and with tried to have the same thing with the oil-producing states, you were not going to have such stability. It wasn't going to work very well. You always had to challenge one of the three. But it was that set of relationships that shaped the first decades of this so-called special relationship. And that meant that the pro-Israel lobby in the United States, which had existed for decades, but had not until 67 had not had major influence, suddenly it was very influential, not least because it looked like it was on the winning side. You know, it's like if you push a car that's parked and with a brake on, You push it and push it, it's not going anywhere. But if a car is cruising downhill and you run behind it looking like you're pushing, you're going to look really powerful, right? So the Israel lobby began to look a lot more powerful than it really was. And then when there was changes at the end of the Cold War, suddenly the strategic value of Israel diminishes. And that's the point when we see, for example, in 1991 with the Iraq War, Israel is ordered by the US to keep its air force on the ground, not to attack, because the US needed an Arab coalition to go against Iraq. And the Israelis went along with it. When that period ended with after 9/11, and suddenly the so-called global war on terror is the main thing going on, suddenly Israel is again a strategic ally. So when the strategy part is important, you see that as the main thing that we hear about. When it's not so important, you hear about the internal, the role of the lobby becomes much more important. So the intersection of the lobby and the strategic interests threads through this entire period and still exists today. So that's my short version. It can go on, but there's stuff in the book about it. I hope people will find the book useful.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Appreciate you. Have you back soon.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fortnox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.